dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And
this week you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week on the program, we continue where we left off last week in Chapter 4 on Money and Property in Charles Eisenstein's 2006 book, The Ascent of Humanity, The Age of Separation, The Age of Reunion, and the Convergence of Crises that is birthing the transition. This chapter finally brings us to the creation of money and property, the abstractions that have come to rule us by what he calls their anonymizing power. Eisenstein does not see money and property as the cause of our problems, but rather a manifestation and intensifier of the worldview of separation. Money is a technology that allows for the most absolute form of separation from others. It allows one to meet one's needs without any personal relationship or obligation, and therefore it results in the destruction of community and its conquest of every form of interaction in life is the barrier toward the community that so many people want to create but seem to have such difficulty bringing into being within the framework of the society specifically designed to replace love with money. Eisenstein has referred to this whole long process as the age of separation, but I would call it the age of prostitution. And in fact, it coincides very well with the conversion of women to property and commodity. Every creative thing has been prostituted. The creative act of working has been turned into slavery. The ecstasy of lovemaking into a business transaction. Previously in the book, Eisenstein made the point that the project of domination and control reflected by science, technology, and the age of reason springs from the same tree as the religious faith, which is now spoken of as its antagonist. Before I resume reading from Eisenstein, let me deepen that understanding for you by sharing something I recently learned through reading elsewhere. It's going to say it all. During the Middle Ages, the brothels were mostly owned by the church or by the secular government. The brothels on London's South Bank were owned by the Bishop of London, who received profits from them. They were seen as a necessary evil to prevent the assault on the property of men, namely women's bodies, by other men unable to satisfy their biological needs, who were not able to enter into the institution of marriage. Prostitutes were allowed to participate in all the sacraments and rituals of the church, as it was considered that they were engaging in an activity to earn a wage, to provide a surface that was, if unpleasant, socially necessary. It was not considered a sin, so long as the women did not receive any pleasure from the sexual activity, but only considered it work for money. Doesn't that tell you everything you need to know? Civilization has long been spoken of as an improvement to nature, barbaric, red in tooth and claw. But it is civilization that has performed the type of atrocities that no animal would ever ever perform. It is civilization that is red in tooth and claw. And that is the paradox of the age of separation. So now I continue with The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein with the next section, Cultural Capital. How is it possible to own the stars? To whom do they belong? The businessman retorted peevishly. I don't know, to nobody. Then they belong to me because I was the first person to think of it. The Little Prince. Cultural capital refers to the cumulative products of the human mind, including language, art, stories, music, and ideas. Only recently have they been considered valid objects of property rights, and only recently have they been produced by specialists for the consumption of the masses. In hunter-gatherer days, while some people probably had exceptional talents in art or music, there was no separate category of artist or musician because everybody was both. To sing and play an instrument, to dance, to draw, to create beautiful objects from the materials available in the environment is as natural a part of being human as it is to walk, talk, and play. The atrophy of these functions began with the advent of the Neolithic division of labor and accelerated as the division of labor intensified with the Industrial Revolution, which also created the means to replace them with mass-produced substitutes. Let's look at the example of music. Before the invention of the phonograph, practically any social gathering involved the playing of instruments and the singing of songs. People sang all the time. There was no one, except perhaps the profoundly tone-deaf, who couldn't sing. If in 1880 you went to a dinner party at one of the large Victorian houses still standing in central Pennsylvania, chances are that after dinner, everyone would adjourn to the piano parlor to sing. People sang as they worked and sang as they played. They sang in chain gangs and around campfires. They sang alone, and they sang at virtually any gathering. They sang traditional songs from the old country, and they sang the folk songs of North America. But with the advent of the phonograph, then the radio, and finally the explosion of electronic devices that make recorded music ubiquitous today, the human capacity to sing began a long gradual decline among the general population. Why? Because it was no longer necessary. When we buy recorded music, we are essentially paying someone to sing to us, paying for a function that was once just part of being human. Remember the eternal business idea of finding something people do for themselves, then convincing them to pay for it instead? That is exactly what happened with recorded music. It attracted people with its novelty and the fact that they could listen to the very best singers and musicians in the entire country, whereas before they had to content themselves with the best singer in the family or the town. In comparison, their own voices didn't sound so good anymore, and they became convinced of their own inferiority. Nonetheless, the decline of singing took a very long time. As recently as the 1940s, my father remembers his whole neighborhood getting together every week in the summer in suburban St. Louis to have a picnic and sing the old songs. Such neighborhood get-togethers have become rare these days with the generalized breakdown of community. Even when they do occur, there isn't much singing going on. In colleges half a century ago, students would sing the college songs at parties and football games, or someone would bring a guitar to the campus lawn and people would gather around and sing. Today they'd listen to recorded music at high volume, insulating themselves from the world behind a wall of sound. By the 1970s, the only people still singing were children. They were the only people for whom song was integrated into daily life. I remember sometimes on the elementary school bus, we would sing all the way to school, the whole busload of us. That behavior disappeared by high school. However, we had grown out of it. We had grown out of singing just for the fun of it and not as a performance. How sad. Today, singing on the bus is probably against the rules. Some vestiges of our inborn musicality remain. Musically inclined friends who get together for jam sessions and the like. Such activities are a powerful reclamation of our cultural, social, and spiritual capital. By and large, though, music has become a paid function, a commodity. Something very similar has happened to storytelling. Television has replaced traditional tales as well as family stories and community stories. The old-fashioned storyteller, someone who can spin a good yarn, is a rarity these days. Rare, too, are the types of venues and occasions where her stories might be heard. Instead, through our consumption of television and movies, we pay remote specialists to produce our stories for us. Significantly, the producers of these stories now own them, an unprecedented development. For most of human history, no one imagined you could own a story. Stories were simply not conceivable objects of property, but constituted in each culture a vast commonwealth. Today, corporations such as Disney mine that commonwealth, wall off parts of it for themselves, and convert it into money. A related erosion of cultural capital is the hollowing out and commoditization of our holiday customs and religious traditions. Starting with Christmas, one by one, our holidays have been reduced to the buying of things. Each is a fountain of profit. For Valentine's Day, we buy chocolate and flowers. For Easter, we buy candy. For 4th of July, we buy firecrackers. For Halloween, we buy costumes. Last year, my children were the only ones I saw with homemade costumes. For Christmas, in addition to gifts of all descriptions, we buy wreaths, decorations, and cookies. And for all holidays, we buy greeting cards. A new trend in the restaurant business is Thanksgiving dinner with all the trappings. Why cook it at home when it is so much more efficient to have restaurant chefs do it? Remember again the quintessential business idea. Find something that people still do for themselves and sell it to them instead. The commoditization of our cultural capital has received increased attention recently due to the ongoing controversies over intellectual property and the preservation of the commons in cyberspace. Before discussing these less tangible objects of property, let's examine what property actually means. Functionally, property is merely a social agreement that a subject, individual or corporate, has certain exclusive rights to use a thing in a certain way. These rights vary depending on their object and the society upon which they depend. For example, land ownership confers the right to prohibit trespassers in America, but not in Scandinavia. Trademarks confer the exclusive right to use a word or words for specific commercial purposes. For example, we can say that Walmart owns the word always, even though I can still use that word in this book. Walmart's exclusive right is to use it in a specific commercial context. Not too long ago, I asked a Penn State class how many of them download copyrighted materials from the internet. The show of hands was unanimous. According to the legal definition, I said, you are all thieves. But stealing has a moral as well as legal component. So legal definitions aside, how many of you feel like a thief the way you would if you shoplifted a CD? This time, not a single hand was raised. I continued, so no one feels like a thief. The record industry says that the reason you don't feel like a thief is that you are morally or ethically deficient. Maybe you are ignorant. Maybe you are just plain bad. But perhaps there is another explanation, an explanation more trusting of the moral instincts of that vast majority of young adults who download MP3 files. Maybe the reason my class did not feel like thieves lies not in deficient ethics, but with the concept of intellectual property itself. We understand the purpose of copyrights and patents to be to protect the interests of creators, artists, musicians, and inventors. But interestingly enough, the framers of the United States Constitution cited a rather different reason for authorizing Congress to establish copyrights and patents. Their reason was to promote the progress of science and useful arts. By securing for limited times to authors and inventors, the exclusive rights to their respective writings and discoveries. In other words, they deemed it socially beneficial for creators to be able to profit from their works. But did they think that a person who comes up with an idea should own it? Here are the words of Thomas Jefferson, quote, "If nature has made any one thing less susceptible than all others of exclusive property, it is the action of the thinking power called an idea, which an individual may exclusively possess so long as he keeps it to himself. But the moment it is divulged, it forces itself into the possession of everyone, and the receiver cannot dispossess himself of it. Its peculiar character, too, is that no one possesses the less because every other possesses the whole of it. He who receives an idea from me receives instruction himself without lessening mine, as he who lights his taper at mine receives light without darkening me. That ideas should freely spread from one to another over the globe, for the moral and mutual instruction of man and improvement of his condition, seems to have been peculiarly and benevolently designed by nature when she made them, like fire, expansible over all space, without lessening their density in any point, and like the air in which we breathe, move, and have our physical being, incapable of confinement or exclusive appropriation. Inventions then cannot in nature be a subject of property." Close quote. Reflecting the founders' reservations about owning ideas, the Constitution prescribes that patents and copyrights are to be valid only for a limited time. The earliest legislation enacted limited terms indeed. Copyrights lasted just 14 years and could be renewed for 14 more. Today, copyrights last the entire life of the author plus an additional 70 years, or 95 years for corporate copyrights. Artists and inventors were not considered to own their ideas at all, but simply to enjoy an exclusive but highly circumscribed right to profit from them. It is this distinction that justifies the institution of the lending library. But today the distinction has crumbled. Not only is it illegal to sell copies of a movie, it is illegal to copy it at all. In a former time, the student's actions would have been neither illegal nor considered unethical. If books were invented in today's legal climate, the lending library would surely not exist. The reasons for setting time limits on patents and copyright are both practical and moral. Practically speaking, when someone has exclusive rights over a creation for too long, the effect is to stymie innovation, not promote it. That is because art, music, and technology build upon themselves. Their history is one of constant borrowing and self-referencing. Art and music draw from the cultural milieu that surrounds them, which is itself comprised in part of the art and music already in currency. Today, because of the intellectual property law, many types of artistic expression are essentially illegal. For example, the digital age enables us to re-edit music and movies, to weave new material into them, to manipulate them in countless ways, that is, to use them as raw material for continued creativity. It is technologically feasible for any PC owner, but legally impossible for anyone without vast amounts of capital to purchase rights. More generally, when culture is private property, then artistic creation which draws on the culture must trespass or be severely limited. When the propertization of the cultural space, the enclosure of the cultural commons becomes total, it will become impossible to create art at all without asking permission. Already something like this is happening in the film industry, as Lawrence Lessig explains in The Future of Ideas. Wait, in an extremely ironic turn of events, just as I was about to quote Lessig, I saw a notice that said, quote, "No part of this excerpt may be reproduced or reprinted without permission in writing from the publisher," close quote. Not wishing to go through the hassle of obtaining such permission, I'll paraphrase instead. Lessig quotes filmmaker Davis Guggenheim that in making a film, it is necessary to procure rights to all the images it contains. A poster in the background, a Coke trademark can, a piece of furniture because it was created by a designer, a building whose image might belong to the architect, all might require copyright clearance. Soon there will be nothing left to film, except with permission, as the propertization of images proceeds toward totality. Increasingly, says Guggenheim, the lawyers determine the content of a film. These issues generate actual court cases. Lessig gives several examples. 12 monkeys suspended when an artist claimed that a chair in the movie resembled a piece of furniture he designed. Batman Forever threatened when an architect demanded money for the image of a courtyard the Batmobile drove through. The Devil's Advocate because of some sculptures that appeared in the background. There, I think I did that without breaking any laws or encroaching on Mr. Lessig's property rights to those sequences of words he now owns. It wasn't easy, though, because the clearest articulation was the one Mr. Lessig employed himself. Similarly, a filmmaker can try to use only images from the public domain, but because modern life happens in a proprietary realm, certain sentiments are difficult to express. McDonald's, for example, is a potent cultural symbol. There is no good substitute. The filmmaker must settle for a reduced stock of images, just as I had to settle for a reduced stock of phrases, in paraphrasing Lawrence Lessig. A similar situation pertains to technological innovation. As the free use of scientific discoveries is increasingly limited by legal ownership over their applications. In the realm of biomedical science, the traditional free exchange of information, strains of organisms, and so forth is crumbling because genetically engineered microorganisms can now be patented, that is, made into property. In the past, scientific process was based on cooperation more than competition. People shared new results in journals and through informal exchange, protected by their university salaries from the compulsion to profit financially from their work. Now that careers depend in part on corporate research funding, and now that researchers and universities have a pecuniary interest in patenting results, a new era of secrecy has dawned. It originates from the profit potential inherent in the patentability of new pharmaceuticals and genetically modified organisms. Contrary to the founders' intentions, intellectual property in this case stymies scientific development, because science progresses by building on the results of previous science. When the incentive is to conceal instead of to share, this is no longer possible. What else could we expect from the conversion of scientific knowledge into property, which is nothing else than the enclosure of part of the commons into a private holding? The moral case against property rights over ideas rests on a similar basis. Ideas do not just appear out of thin air. They coalesce from the raw materials of the cultural commonwealth and depend upon the ambient culture for their resonance and relevance. Mickey Mouse, for example, is appealing mostly because he is A, a small, humble creature, a mouse, and B, he looks cute. An effect achieved by drawing him with large eyes, large ears, and a small body relative to his head. Mickey's appeal, and therefore his tremendous commercial success, draw upon factors, cultural raw materials, and the transcultural features of human perception that are part of the Commonwealth. Recently, there was a court case between Exxon and Kellogg over the cartoon tigers used to market their brands. The Exxon Gas Tiger and Tony the Tiger. The two look quite similar, as well as to Tigger of Winnie the Pooh fame and to Hobbes from the comic strip Calvin and Hobbes. One of these two corporations claimed that the other infringed on its trademark rights, in effect asserting property rights over a certain rendering of an animal, the tiger, that has very deep cultural resonance. Tigers may be a part of nature, but the idea and image of a tiger, with all its associations of strength, power, and beauty, is a kind of cultural capital. Since there are really only a limited number of ways to draw a tiger and have it still look like a tiger and carry these associations, the litigants were in effect asserting private ownership over an item of cultural capital that was once public, unowned. Whenever someone gets an idea for a story, is it really original? Perhaps all stories are only variations on a handful of archetypal plots. And certainly all stories draw from the storyteller's experience with real people and real events. Certainly she may put them together in a unique way, but can she in all modesty lay claim to ownership of that story? Reading academic exegesis of literary works, it is impossible to avoid the feeling that the original authors could not possibly have intended all that. Such intent is unnecessary if they are but channels and not creators of their stories. I agree with Lewis Hyde that any creative work comes from a source greater than ourselves. Through us, the muse delivers great archetypes and universal themes. To claim ownership of them is to subordinate a greater to a lesser. The true artist is humbled before his work. I've expressed some ideas in a new way and applied some ancient ideas to certain aspects of modern life. But I do not presume to own the ideas themselves, nor the words used to express them. How dare I presume? In one form or another, these ideas have inhabited human minds for thousands of years. In each era, they take on a new appearance. It would be hubris to enclose part of our common human heritage as my own personal property. That is one reason I'm putting the entire content of this book online. And while I'm at it, I hereby give everyone permission to reproduce, reprint, store in a retrieval system, or transmit by any means, electronic, mechanical, photocopying, recording, or otherwise, this book, as long as it isn't for commercial purposes. I do not give you permission to repackage and sell these words. Any copy you make, you may only give away for free. The current rush to own melodies, words, images, algorithms, and even the code of life itself is a new enclosure movement, much akin to the privatization of the village commons by the English Enclosure Acts of the 17th and 18th centuries. Words that were once public and available for all to use are now the property of corporations and other institutions, unavailable to others for certain uses. I'm Lovin' It is the property of the McDonald's Corporation. It has the exclusive right to a certain use of that phrase. Make every drop count is the property of Coca-Cola. Ideas for Life is the property of Panasonic. Always is the property of Walmart. Making Life Better is the property of Penn State. You can still use these words for most purposes, but not as a slogan for your organization. Penn State has taken them. Nike has Just Do It. Donald Trump has taken You're Fired. These are but a few of the tens of thousands of common phrases that have been expropriated from the public language. Even the words love thy neighbor, which appear in both the Torah and the New Testament, and lie at the foundation of moral philosophy, are now subject to ownership. In 2001, a Michigan jewelry merchant using love your neighbor sued a Florida charity named Love Thy Neighbor for trademark infringement, claiming that the similar name confused customers and resulted in lost profits. The defendant said he was flabbergasted that it is possible to register rights to an expression that has been around for 5,700 years. Legalisms aside, does the plaintiff really have a right to this phrase? Did he create it and invent the concept? Or has he merely cordoned off a part of the cultural commonwealth and claimed it for his own use and profit, solely on the justification of having gotten there first? What of music? Do we just invent new songs out of nothing? Do we really invent new melodies and tell new stories? Or are these things cobbled together out of the myriad works of creators past, free-floating ideas plucked out of the noosphere and arranged to appeal to a given audience, or at their best, to a universal audience? To a medieval minstrel, to claim ownership over a song and demand others not play it would have seemed a brazen conceit. To a tribal storyteller, such an attitude might have seemed well-nigh blasphemous, Stories and songs were sacred gifts from the gods. A similar argument pertains to technological inventions. They too are born of a complex creative matrix, inspired by ideas ambient in the culture. Hence, Lewis Mumford defined the patent as, quote, a device that enables one man to claim special financial rewards for being the last link in the complicated social process that produced the invention, close quote. To claim ownership over what is not rightfully yours is theft. To stake out a permanent claim in the commons of our cultural heritage is to steal from us all. Seen this way, students downloading music and movies are simply defying our new era's land grab on the intellectual commons. They sense what Thomas Jefferson articulated so well, that no person has a moral right to own an idea. It is tempting to say that the riches of our cultural heritage should remain public property, but to use this term reinforces a dangerous underlying assumption, that the word property can be made to apply to them at all. The cultural commons, like the village commons before it, was once the world outside the sphere of human ownership. Today there is no such sphere. The separate human realm of the owned has expanded to cover all. I am advocating a revolution in human beingness that goes much deeper than a mere Marxist shift of property from individual to common ownership. Property itself will become an outmoded concept. A great hubris is implicit in the very concept of ownership. Ownership subordinates a thing to a human being, makes what was large and wild into a possession, something of ourselves. Wendell Berry has said he, meaning God, is the wildest being in existence. The presence of his spirit in us is our wildness, our oneness with the wilderness of creation. That is why subduing the things of nature to human purposes is so dangerous, and why it so often results in evil, in separation and desecration. Close quote. Of course, the things of nature, culture, and spirit that we attempt to subdue by making them into property are not subdued in reality, but only in our perception. Only in our perception are they reduced to possessions, something no longer larger than ourselves but smaller, no longer the mystery of the unknown but the catalog of the owned. For what is it for a thing to be mine? Do I change its essence thereby, by imagining I own it? All of what we call intellectual property, patents, phrases, text, images, sounds, are pieces of the cultural universe that we separate out and make private. What is it to make something private, to make property of something? What really changes? Does the song know when its royalty rights have been transferred? Does the story know when the copyright has expired? What has changed is really our own collective perception of it. Property is, after all, a social convention, an agreement about someone's exclusive right to use a thing in specified ways. However, we seem to have forgotten this. We seem to think that property belongs to us in some essential way, that it is of us. We seem to think that our property is part of ourselves, and that by owning it, we therefore make ourselves more, larger, greater. Significantly, it is force that backs up the social agreement defining property. If I defy that agreement by trespassing on your land, you can threaten or apply physical force through police proxies, for instance, to maintain your socially defined exclusive rights. Property encodes power relationships among human beings. Less commonly recognized is that property embodies a relationship to the world at large, no less fraught with force and control. Changing our concept of ownership and abandoning the conversion of the universe into property involves a fundamentally different conception of ourselves in relation to the world. It involves a letting go, a relaxing of boundaries, a trusting in once what was so quaintly known as providence, instead of reining in the whole world, bringing it under control, making it ours. In the propertization of everything, we find an echo of the technological program of perfect control and the scientific program of perfect understanding upon which it is based. Our socioeconomic system and our way of life is inseparable from our beliefs about reality, our ontology, our cosmology, and our self-definition. It is about making it ours, conquering nature, conquering the mystery. To conquer means to make ours, and that means to own. To assign property rights to all reality is indeed to become the lords and masters of the universe. The world of property is precisely the separate human realm whose emergence we have traced back to fire, stone, language, and number. It is a world labeled, numbered, subordinated to human ownership. It is a world whose value we define in terms of money, a purely human abstraction, and a proxy for the interest of the separate self. As more of the world enters the money economy, the separate human realm grows and the wild shrinks. All become fuel for the fire that defines the circle of domesticity, blazing so high now that nowhere can we avoid its heat. The realm of the owned continues to expand. Corvette owns a certain shade of red, UPS a certain shade of brown. These are parts of the electromagnetic spectrum. Did these companies create these colors? Or just enclose them, wall them off, and call them theirs? Harley Davidson has done the same thing to the sound of its revving motorcycle engine. To the extent that music, images, and text can be digitized, intellectual property comes down to owning numbers, a next natural step after the conversion of the world to numbers described in Chapter 2. Thus, we have extended ownership to the fundamental stuff of reality, electromagnetic waves, numbers, DNA, sound waves. That these things are considered intellectual property again bespeaks our hubris, that we presume dominion over something far prior to human beings. We have merely taken what was there already, the substrate of reality, whether words or land, at the beginning of the chain of purchase and sale. Someone must have simply appropriated it. As P.J. Proudhon claimed in 1840, property is theft. Our possession of this world we have made ours is grand larceny. And its victim is the Commonwealth, the land, the genome, mother culture. We could say that property is what has been stolen from us all, or from nature, or from God. In any event, our progressive ownership of the world naturally and inevitably accompanies our progressive estrangement from the world, so that in the end we languish in the prison of me and mine, which, no matter how great our possessions, is far narrower and dingier than the unbounded wild from whence we came. And I'm reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. Natural capital. The same people who brought the sewer pipes turn another small piece of the pine barrens into money every few weeks, probably when there's nothing left, and the last of the watershed is poisoned. The people who are responsible for killing the beaver will know the helpless sense of irreversible loss Rick and I had felt. Tom Brown, Jr. In no realm is the campaign to make it all ours so concrete as in the conversion of natural capital to financial capital. Natural capital refers to the earth itself, the earth's minerals, land, soil, oceans, fresh water, genomes, and biota, everything that is that was not created by human beings. I would like to say natural resources, but in this locution lies the very assumption we are examining. To think of the planet as consisting of resources already implies it is ours, defines the world in terms of its usefulness to us, and sets us separate and apart in relation to it. The most commonly recognized form of natural capital is fossil fuel, comprising coal, oil, and natural gas, which we are depleting at an accelerating rate. These are Tom Hartman's last days of ancient sunlight, upon which industrial society depends. However, while the energy crisis certainly does contribute to the convergence of crises that will undo the age of separation, it's only a tiny part of the picture. Other forms of natural capital are probably even more significant. First is the Earth's capacity to absorb the toxic effluvia of our conversion of wealth to money. the radioactive waste and the pharmaceutical residues, the agricultural runoff and the incinerator sludge, the sulfur dioxide and the ozone, the CFCs and the PCBs. Once localized or subclinical in their effects, these poisons now threaten entire bioregions and ecosystems. Wait, did I say threaten? That isn't the right word anymore, because many of them are already dead, and many more are dying. As the damage intensifies, the consequences will be harder to avoid. Indeed, they are already upon us in the rise of birth defects, autoimmune diseases, and cancer. But that is nothing compared to the possible disruption of climatic systems and the mechanisms of atmospheric homeostasis that depend on a healthy ecology. Another urgent problem is the loss of fertile soil and clean water. Deserts have been swallowing fertile land ever since linear methods were first applied to agriculture. Ancient Sumer, the cradle of civilization, was once known as the Fertile Crescent. Now it is the desert of Iraq. North Africa, once the breadbasket of the Roman Empire, is now wholly given to the Great Sahara. The same fate awaits the United States, where topsoil losses of 2 billion tons per year are 17 times higher than the rate of soil formation, and especially the drier West, where dependency on irrigation exposes vast tracts to salinization. Meanwhile, chemical agriculture contributes to an alarming depletion of soil minerals, as USDA statistics on fruits and vegetables, which have as little as 10 or 20% the mineral content of two generations ago. Let me repeat that. USDA statistics on fruits and vegetables, which have as little as 10 or 20% the mineral content of two generations ago, demonstrate. As for water, water tables are dropping on every continent. Great rivers such as the Yellow and the Colorado routinely run dry, and the Nile and the Ganges barely make it to the sea. The Aral Sea has shrunk to half its former size, killing all fish due to higher salinity. Meanwhile, according to the World Medical Association, over half the world population lacks access to potable water, while even in America, tap water is routinely treated with chlorine to destroy waterborne pathogens. Increasingly, it is polluted also with various carcinogens, mutagens, and endocrine disruptors. Of course, like any other destruction of the Commonwealth, this presents a great business opportunity. The fastest growing beverage category is now bottled water, now a commodity like everything else. While huge corporations battle for control of newly privatized water utilities around the world. Some people object to these gloom and doom scenarios by pointing out examples like the Great Lakes, where water quality has actually improved. Yes, there have been temporary localized improvements. Too often, though, the pollution has merely been exported. Factories in China producing the same heavy industrial products once made in Cleveland and Milwaukee spew the same pollutants as before into different rivers. Air quality may have improved in Los Angeles, but the worsening air in Bangkok, Manila, and Shanghai more than offsets that improvement. Some pollutants are now banned and some practices abandoned, but others more insidious have taken their place. Nonetheless, mine is not actually a gloom and doom viewpoint. I am an optimist. My optimism does not depend, however, on ignoring the gravity of our situation. It will take an extraordinary transformation in human beingness to create the beautiful world my heart tells me is possible. I'll touch upon just one other category of disappearing natural capital, biodiversity. The totality of the planet's plants, animals, bacteria, and fungi contain an enormous reservoir of genetic material that, once lost, can never be recovered. Typically, environmentalists cite two reasons for preserving this irreplaceable form of wealth. First, diverse ecosystems are more robust and better able to exercise their function in the homeostasis of the biosphere to manufacture oxygen, for example. Second, the innumerable species presently going extinct might contain valuable medicinal compounds, genetic material, or other components useful to human beings. These are good reasons, but they understate the case. Science is learning that much, if not most, genetic material is never expressed. Once considered junk, this DNA is potentially a reservoir of adaptability that may become essential to the planet's survival and or transformation. Of course, the idea that genes are waiting, quiescent within the genome, for the time for their expression violates the basic principles of Darwinian evolution, as there is no selection mechanism. I will develop this line of reasoning more fully in later chapters. When people become aware of the catastrophic destruction of natural capital, they either go into denial, it couldn't be that bad, or I can't do anything about it, or they quite rightly become extremely alarmed and think, we must mend our ways. However, the origin of our ways is much deeper than we think. We can dream of tighter regulations or more reverent attitudes toward Earth, more responsible governments and better technology, but the tragic fact is that our civilization is constitutionally incapable of reversing the annihilation of natural capital or even slowing it down. That destruction flows inevitably from the money system and the sense of self that underlies it. I will repeat that. That destruction flows inevitably from the money system and the sense of self that underlies it. Get used to that. When we really understand that, the project of reconceiving civilization itself will gain powerful impetus. The subjugation of all the Earth's land and everything on it and under it starts with a conceptual separation, an objectification of the world that facilitates its conversion first into resources, then into property, and finally into money. Older history textbooks speak of how the West was won, while newer, more progressive editions might give lip service to the idea that the North American continent was stolen from its original inhabitants, the Native Americans. From the indigenous perspective, though, the true crime is much greater than that. The crime of the Europeans went far beyond murdering the Native Americans for, quote, their land, which perhaps would not have been unthinkable to the indigenous mind. After all, territorial disputes are not unknown among hunter-gatherers. The crime, the sin, the sacrilege, was to presume to take the land not from humans, but from something greater, from nature, God, the spirit that moves all things. America was not stolen from the Indians because the Indians never owned it. The land was not property. While pre-agricultural peoples often have a tribal territory, they would be appalled at the idea that the land could be owned. Is not the earth a being greater than any human or even any group of humans? How can a greater belong to a lesser? To presume to own a piece of the earth, to say it is mine, is from the indigenous perspective a sacrilege so audacious as to be unthinkable. To reduce the earth to property and eventually to money is indeed to make a greater into a lesser, to turn the sacred into the profane, the divine into the human, the infinite into the quantified. I can think of no better definition of sacrilege than that. If the mass murder of the world's indigenous peoples constitutes a crime against humanity, then the objectification of the world constitutes a crime against nature, God, and spirit. In fact, the former crime flows naturally and inexorably out of the latter. How much easier is it to kill someone or something that we see as an other? The original source of both crimes is nothing other than separation itself, a process as old as time that received successive boosts from fire, agriculture, the machine, and science. But it was agriculture that most powerfully accelerated the conversion of land into thing. It is easy to see how the concept of land ownership arose with agriculture. Agriculture involves applying labor to a piece of land, tilling the soil, planting seeds, pulling up weeds, watering plants, fertilizing the soil, and so forth. A farmer has a right to the fruits of his labor and would certainly object to someone coming by and gathering the abundant edible crops he has grown there. However, there is still a huge conceptual leap from owning the crops to owning the land itself. In some societies, the only owner of the land was the king. As the king was considered a semi-divine being, this was tantamount to saying that land was beyond the domain of human ownership. Early ownership of land was probably more akin to a generally recognized right of stewardship, ensuring people had the incentive to work the land and could justly benefit from their labors. just as early intellectual property rights meant to encourage creativity by bestowing the temporary right to profit from an idea, but not ownership of the idea itself. Whether in the case of land or intellectual property, the transformation from a right to benefit into outright ownership was a gradual one. Let's keep in mind that this was a conceptual transformation. The land doesn't admit to being owned, a human projection onto reality. Land ownership, and indeed all forms of ownership, says more about our perception of the world than about the nature of the thing owned. The transition from the early days when ownership of land was as unthinkable as ownership of the sky, sun, and moon to the present day, when nearly every square foot of the earth is subject to ownership of one sort or another, is really just the story of our changing view of ourselves in relation to the universe. The ending of serfdom in late medieval Europe is a case in point. Before feudalism gave way to a money economy and the commons migrated into private hands, land was not generally a fungible asset. Lewis Hyde writes, quote, "Whereas before a man could fish in any stream and hunt in any forest, now he found there were individuals who claimed to be the owners of these commons. The basis of land tenure had shifted. The medieval serf had been almost the opposite of a property owner. The land had owned him. He could not move freely from place to place, yet he had inalienable rights to the piece of land to which he was attached. Now men claimed to own the land and offered to rent it out at a fee. While a serf could not be removed from his land, a tenant could be evicted only through the failure to pay the rent, but merely at the whim of the landlord." Close quote. I would like to insert myself here that Lewis Hyde is not entirely correct. That a man could fish in any stream and hunt in any forest, very much not the case. Hunting and fishing in streams was controlled by the nobility, and the noble who had control of that land on behalf of the sovereign was the only one entitled to hunt and fish there. Anyone else doing so could be subject to extreme and gruesome penalties that usually involved cutting off of limbs, or even putting people to death. And by the way, those serfs who worked on the land could not move freely from it, but they were also required to pay rents, a portion of their labor or their produce that would go to the lord, the feudal lord, who was the holder of it in the name of the sovereign. Complementing the reduction of land to just another thing, in the same period, Martin Luther and his ilk absolved worldly rulers of any obligation to rule by Christian principles, accelerating the separation of reality into two realms, worldly and divine. We became lords and masters of the real world, banishing God to a materially inconsequential realm of the otherworldly. Land, like the rest of the world, was no longer sacred. Of course, the peasants resisted their dispossession from the commons, fomenting the bloody struggle known in Germany as the Peasants' War. It is a struggle reenacted time and again around the globe, whenever people resisted the incursion of property rights into yet another sphere of human relationship. As Hyde puts it, quote, "The Peasants' War was the same war that the American Indians had to fight with the Europeans, a war against the marketing of formerly inalienable properties," close quote. Relationships, land, water, what's next? The air, the sky? Here's a corollary to the eternal business idea of the previous section. Find something so fundamental to life that no one could imagine it being separated off as property, then by some means deprive people of it and sell it back to them. As recently as 17th century England and frontier America, there was much land that was not owned at all, the commons. Today we have reached the opposite extreme from the days of hunter-gatherers. It is hard for people to conceive of land not being owned. Surely someone must own it. It just can't be there unowned, can it? I like to stump my students by asking them for examples of unowned land. National parks, state forests, and the like don't count because they are owned by the government, not unowned. Basically, the only unowned land, the only commons still remaining in present-day America is the street. The street is public space maintained and regulated by municipal governments, but not the subject of any deed. Other than the street, and perhaps Antarctica, All the world's land service has been made into mine, yours, his, theirs, ours. When I say that as hunter-gatherers we were embedded in nature, part of nature, or not separate from nature, it does not mean only that we, quote, lived more naturally. It means we did not see nature as a separate thing from ourselves. The dualism between man and nature did not exist. Tom Brown Jr. speaks of a boyhood experience lying beneath the stars, quote, "We lay for an hour looking up into the black, star-filled sky until at some point, although I never closed my eyes, I was no longer lying in a field. I had become part of a pattern that the stars and the breeze and the grass and the insects were all a part of. There was no awareness of this until I heard the first deer coming through the grass. Then I was suddenly aware that I had been lying there without thoughts or sensations other than just being," close quote. Aside from being conceptually embedded in nature, hunter-gatherers also had a practical reason for having a very limited concept of property. They were largely nomadic and could not carry many possessions with them. Accumulation of possessions was impossible. Agriculture was the practical and conceptual foundation of the age of property. Practically, it permitted a sedentary lifestyle and the accumulation of possessions. Agriculture also gave rise to greater concentrations of population, social hierarchies, and specialization, all of which further propelled the development of property rights and money. On the conceptual level, the fact that a farmer applies work to the land rather than simply taking what the land has to offer contributes to the feeling that the land is his. More generally, agriculture and the entire corpus of technology that developed in agricultural civilizations sought to control or improve upon nature, thus turning nature into another, the object of manipulation and thus the object of ownership. Once the dualistic man-nature conception had been established, it is quite understandable how people would feel free to convert that of nature into that of man. That is precisely the process that the term natural resources implies. Resources, things for us to use, or to conserve and use later, or not to use at all, in any event, things for us. The millennia-long conversion of natural capital into financial capital is this process in action. Environmentalists have told us for many years that we are, quote, living off our capital, creating an illusion of wealth through the unsustainable consumption of our natural capital. The root of the problem is that our economic system does not recognize the things of nature as wealth. It is written into the dynamics of business that natural capital can be converted as rapidly and efficiently as possible into financial capital, regardless of the ethics, morals, or good intentions of business people. Government regulation can at best slow down this conversion by offering obstacles to its efficiency. One of the gravest errors activists make is to demonize their opponents. For example, to assume that business people and the rich are more greedy, less conscious, or less spiritually evolved than themselves. But greed is a result and not a cause of our economic system. Imagine that Acme Corporation owns a mine, but the CEO, being a nice guy, refuses to operate it because to do so would be to deplete the precious groundwater of the region. A mine that would otherwise produce $12 million a year lies abandoned. Acme's profits, being $12 million lower than they could be, are reflected in the total value of the company, which is perhaps $200 million lower, $1 billion instead of $1.2 billion. When the shareholders find out about the mine, they put pressure on management to exploit it, perhaps even suing the CEO for failing to act in the financial interests of the shareholders. If he resists, tremendous pressure will be brought to bear. Competitors who have no such scruples will undersell Acme's mine products, and the company may attract the attention of a corporate raider who will leverage the $200 million equity that the mine represents into a $1 billion loan from an investment bank, buy the company, exploit the mine, perhaps selling it for $200 million, pay back the loan with $50 million in interest to the bank, and keep $150 million for himself. The same fate befalls a company that spends extra money on pollution control, higher wages, or any other socially or environmentally responsible behavior. The reason is that the costs of such behavior are external to the company's balance sheets. In fact, such costs are called externalities in economics, a word which reflects the separation of man and nature implicit in technology, that is, the making of an other out of nature.